With respect to the Iraqi security forces, there's been a great deal of misinformation that's been thrown around in this country. You know, and we have told this committee on repeated occasions, that in the early periods they included the site protection people, so the numbers were higher by some 80,000. We've said that. It's in the material that's presented to your committee every week or two. There's an asterisk in there, a footnote. It says it. We've repeated it. And to then pull that number out and say it's less today, it seems to me, is misleading. I will say that the idea that what's happening over there is a quagmire is so fundamentally inconsistent with the facts. The reality is that they are making political progress without question. Reality is that the American forces that are training and equipping and mentoring the Iraqi security forces are doing a darn good job, and the number has been going up steadily and consistently. And I'd be happy to have General Abizaid or General Casey mention the effective work they're doing. To denigrate them and to suggest that they're not capable, to be sure they're not like U.S. forces. They're never going to be like U.S. forces. There isn't an army or a navy or an air force on the face of the earth.
The hell up, Rumsfeld. This nonsense about the information about the Iraqi security force is misleading, or what's going on over there. Misleading? Oh, you mean all those head coffins we're building is not for the heads of the imperialist soldiers and Confederates that are getting flopped off? And then you have the nerve to say there's not a quagmire. Okay, well, let's just say that the U.S. military and imperial machine is just mired down, quacking every way it can to try to find some air. And then you try to talk about there's a political progress in Iraq. Well, that may have an element of truth. There's political progress for the oil workers that didn't let you break them down to the ridiculous salary that you wanted, and were able to pop it up to $100 a week. There's political progress for the insurgents who are battling on their fronts, but political progress for the imperial structure is slave time. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1, Santa Cruz with Skidmark, 106.7, Illinois, 107.5, North Carolina, LUVER.com, the world, RadioForAll.net, the universe, and click in, Slave Revolt Radio, Google Web, and find out what's happening in the Slave Web universe. Tonight, we're going to blast our way into how the race card game is played against black people in the form of the pathology game. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Seekers everywhere, I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no conception and no way to measure what the amount of
Alright, you know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight what we're going to deal with is the Black Pathology game. J.L. King is a bisexual black writer. He's written a book called On the Down Low, and it deals with men who are bisexual who don't tell their female spouses that they are having affairs with men. They keep it on the quote-unquote down low. We're going to examine this phenomenon as it's kind of taken off and explore how these things are often ratcheted up by the corporate media and other likes to fulfill a particular agenda. JL was on Hard Knock Radio with Davey B. And they discussed these issues. So first, let's hear Davey let JL explain what he means by this concept and what is his expertise on this topic. And then we'll take it from there. So check this out.
Recognize the name J.L. King. He's the one that wrote the book Living on the Down Low.
On the Down Low.
On the Down Low. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, they kind of know because they've seen you on Oprah. They read the New York Times articles.
A lot of people. Jet Magazine.
Right. A lot of people in this area have probably read the book.
Mm-hmm.
But let's familiarize our audience, especially our hip-hop audience here,
okay.
A little bit about who you are and what you wrote and why you wrote it and how we describe the down low.
First of all, I want to thank you for allowing me to be on your show to help promote my new book coming up, From the Down Low. And whenever I do any type of media, the first thing they want to do is to take people back to a year ago when my book, the best-selling book, On the Down Low, was released, and the open show and what happened after that. By now, everybody under the sound of my voice should have heard about or know about Brothers on the Down Low. Basically, it's bisexuality kept in the closet for my particular area of expertise, African-American men who have sex with men who do not consider themselves to be gay, homosexual, or even bisexual. Mm-hmm. However, down low term means different things to different people. If you ask gay men, have you ever been on the down low? They would probably tell you yes, because to them, that meant they didn't want anybody to know that they were gay.
Right.
So instead of using the word closet, they use the word, I keep my sexuality on the down low.
Right.
If you ask a heterosexual man, has he ever been on the down low? Men who cheated on their wives or girlfriends would probably say, yes, I had a down low relationship because I had a girlfriend on the side and my wife or other girlfriend did not know it. And originally, it started out as the main reason the word down low was used.
Right. And then it changed to creeping.
Is it creeping?
See, you know? After you came out, they said, oh, we're creeping.
Yeah, we're creeping now because we don't want to say we're down low. Because, you know, if you go back, you know, TLC, R. Kelly, the Isley Brothers, Brian McKnight, all used the down low phrase in their lyrics when they were talking about a man who was cheating on his woman with another woman.
Right.
If you ask African-American men who are bisexual but do not want to accept the fact that they are bisexual, then they now are called down-low men. The down-low term was put on married men who were having sex with other men from gay men, because gay men called these men down-low men, men who they were having sex with, and they knew that these men were married or had girlfriends or lived a straight life.
Right.
Outside of their bedrooms.
Right. And you were one of these people at one point.
Yes, but I was on the DL. I was president of the DL Nation.
All right, so you get a flavor of how this is starting off. He doesn't really say a whole lot except, you know, what his particular expertise, and that he concentrates primarily on black people. But I wanted to first outline, you know, his overall concept and what his concept of down low represents. So first, though, now let's move on to JL as he describes his experience since writing the book on the down low. Check it out.
Let me go back before we get any deeper into this conversation, because I always have to put three disclaimers on the table.
Okay.
Whenever I do any type of interviews. My disclaimer number one, not all black men are on the down low.
Right.
That's very important for me to say that, since I am the expert behind the subject.
Right.
Because right now, women around this country are accusing every brother of being on the down low.
So,
because of fear, because of paranoia, because of all the media attention being put on this issue over the past several years.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since I did the Oprah show on the cover of Jet Magazine, sisters have come up to me everywhere and said, yo, I don't like black men. I hate black men. I'm never going to have sex again. All men are gay or on a DL or prison or one white women. What's going on with brothers? As a father of two sons,
mm-hmm.
who are not confused about their sexuality, who are not living a double life or living in denial about their sexual orientation, they have been accused of being on the down low for the sheer fact they're my sons.
Yeah.
I meet brothers all over this country who come up to me and say, bruh, because of your book, because of your work, because of you being on Oprah, I can't even get a date without me, A, having to get 5 references, B, showing her my medical records, C, being interrogated by her and her family because they think that I'm having sex or could have sex with men. Number two, other ethnic groups are dealing with the same behavior.
Right, that was going to be my next question.
It's not a black thing.
Okay.
Sure, white men don't call it down low. They call it keeping it in the closet. If you look and do your homework, the Asian community, the Latino community, all have dealt with this secret society of men who are bisexual, who's not shared with their mates.
But you're the one that got on Oprah and was on New York Times,
yeah.
and all that. So how come we don't hear about it as much, or how come it doesn't have the same weight? And this is the, not to cut you off, talking with J.L. King, author of the book coming up From the Down Low.
Okay, so now you can start to see how some of this stuff is headed. It's in its classic form, where you get people who are concentrated on, quote-unquote, the Negro. Now, he admits that all people within this society have this kind of, quote-unquote, keep-it-under-wraps type of scenario. Now, one, if one is honest to start breaking down, what, why would they? Well, part of it has to do with the structure of a homophobic society. I mean, it was Crime Bill Clinton who came out with this don't ask, don't tell. So here you have the president of the country outlining a national down low policy for the soldiers or people who wanted to be soldiers. Keep your mouth shut and keep it on the down low. So, but what has ended up happening when J.L. King came out with his little thing and was on Oprah and all, you know, all these little shows, it reached this kind of classic Negro hysteria type thing, the Negro pathology. In other words, in the same way that O.J. represents spousal abuse for many people throughout this country, and Michael Jackson represents pedophilia. You know, here you have all these raggedy Catholic popes or priests or whatever the hell they're called, fondling and doing everything else under the sun to little boys and girls. Yet it's Michael Jackson who symbolizes it. As silly as Michael Jackson is, there's no way that he should become the symbol of this phenomenon. But within this type of society and culture, where it waits for specific scapegoats to blow its interest out mile high, these are the types of things that you get. So, of course, we have this down low type of, quote unquote, to use his words, mentality. Rock Hudson, the so-called, you know, male He-Man movie star, he was doing his little down low thing for years. You had the governor over there in New Jersey. But see, the down low, when it is thrown on black people, it's supposed to represent something else. Sneaky, untrustworthy, undercover, shady, non-reliable, lurking in the dark. So it has all of these connotations that people who have already been stigmatized within this specific society, those things take on mammoth proportions and stuff. But I just mentioned about from the quote-unquote highest levels, crime Bill Clinton, he was advocating a policy of down-lowism in the military. Don't ask, don't tell. But those types of connections are not made when a society is based off of falsehoods, fictions, and misdirections at its core.
You know what, Tracy? I think you pretty much got him. This exaggeration about the sexuality of black males is really a function of racism. Just as Tracy mentioned, how they create these poster boys, you know, for spousal abuse, OJ, pedophilia, Michael Jackson. In reality, we know that there's far more of that stuff going on in the white community, to be perfectly honest. Now, and especially, we do know for a fact about these Catholic churches, because, but understand this, sexual abuse of children, the reason we know it's primarily in the white community is it's a function of men that are economically well off taking advantage of more vulnerable people. You see? And getting away with it. Because it don't do you a lot of good to take advantage of somebody and wind up in prison the next week. Right? And that's why. That's what I mean. I'm not trying to suggest any kind of Farrakhan crap about black people being superior or anything like that. But there are different social relations going on here. There's a reason that these Catholic priests were able to get away with it for years, decades and decades. You know, that chastity stuff don't work. I don't care what they tell you. And how can you tell on God's messenger who's here to save us all? So there was a lot of things working for them when they worked their thing. If we just take alone the Catholic priests and really expand upon that, you'd get sick.
And also, if you ever check out the Afghanistan movie called Osama, and it's about a little girl who's disguised as a boy. And while she's a boy, she is taken by some of these Taliban guys, these little mullah types, to learn proper types of hygiene and etiquette, how to take a bath and all of that. And the writer of the movie... in the director's cut portion where he's describing, you know, how he came up with some of the ideas of the scene, talked about, you know, you had all these little mullah men, Islamic mullahs, running around, and they were all perverted and stuff, you know, lusting after little boys and all of that. And this is why they were going through these extreme types of bath scenes and all of this, of how to take a bath and what, where to do this and that and all of that type of stuff. All this sexual repression. These guys are imploding and this is warped stuff, you know. So you see it in all of these little types of repressive societies. It don't matter if you've been in your little head down to Allah or you know, Jesus or Moses. Get the hell out of here. It's the real world. But next, listen as King takes this discussion into the quote-unquote AIDS phenomenon. So let's move on from there. Check it.
Phenomenon in other ethnic communities, the fact that when you, a black man, talk about it, it becomes a whole different ball of wax. And all people want to gather around a campfire and listen. You know, listen, and it, just like a lot of people listening to this radio show, very intently, want to know what's going on. But I'm wondering if it's a genuine curiosity Is it a genuine concern, if there needs to be a concern, or just to try and better understand, or is it really like, man, I got to hear this. This is off the hook.
It, because, number one, originally in my first book, I dealt with the problem of HIV in our community, that the Centers for Disease Control and other HIV educators have said that one of, not the only, but one of the primary reasons that we are losing so many African-American women is through heterosexual contact, through men who do not consider themselves of being gay, who are having unprotected sex. One of the reasons, not the only reason. Mm-hmm. Because the numbers are so large and so frightening and so scary at what HIV is doing to our community, there's been a lot of focus on this particular behavior. However, it cannot overshadow the fact that if, no matter what your sexual orientation is, if you're having unprotected sex, you don't know your HIV status, then you're going to get infected. It doesn't care anything about you being on a down low or gay or straight. It's about your sexual responsibility.
Right.
Now, the reason there's so much emphasis on this particular issue in the African-American community is because I have been thrown into the spotlight about my own life. It is no greater of an issue in the white community or Latino community as it is in the black community, but because everybody's focusing on J.L. King, his work, his book, Oprah, and the whole nine yards, it seems like it's just a black issue.
Right.
One thing that we have to do, which goes into my third disclaimer, mm-hmm. is understand that this is nothing new. It's been around since the beginning of time. This is not a new phenomenon that started with my new book. It has been around. We have always dealt with bisexual men and gay men in our community. But because of...
But have we dealt with it? Because
we have not dealt with it.
You started off by saying that there is this homophobia mm-hmm. that exists in the community to the point mm-hmm. that people have to be on the DL.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, and so even though we can point to the James Baldwins of the world, and I'm sure there's a number of other people, some famous, not mm-hmm. so famous, and what have you, it hasn't been dealt with. And as you talked about in the church, they're there, in the choir,
everywhere.
Folks are there, they're everywhere, but we haven't dealt with it. So what I want to do is I want to take a music break and come back, and I want to ask you those questions, a couple of questions, why we haven't dealt with it, and is it any different than the way that other communities have dealt with it, so we can put it in its proper context? In other words, are black folks more homophobic than any other folks?
Come on, yeah.
You know, we are. Okay, well, let's find out when we come back.
Well, you know what? Actually, I'm afraid Davey is seriously wrong on this one. I don't care what the man say when they come back. Black people are not necessarily more homophobic than whites. That's just bullshit. I mean, here, and I got proof. All right, let me tell you how. Now, I grew up in New York City, hardcore. And yeah, in the ghetto, you always had that little manhood thing, running around holding your stuff, you know, talking stuff. You know, got your little manhood image and talk stuff about so-called faggots and all of that. But in reality, it's something I noticed very quickly. And that is that homosexuals were not brutalized by our community. People did not go around just beating up homosexuals. But in the white community, it's quite... gay bashing is common. Tell me if I'm wrong. Tell me if I'm wrong here. So, you know, I don't know. But see, here's the adage of racism. Whatever irregularities, wrongs, or problems that whites have, like so-called sexual perversion, drugs, violent behavior, it's 10 times worse with blacks. That's what racist white America must believe. You've got to give these poor people out in the rural areas something to believe. They just can't believe the reality that their lives mean nothing to these capitalists. That they'll take their children off and use them in this horrible war and just send them a flag and a medal and while they're laughing down their sleeve. You understand? See, this, we already talked about the sexual, so-called sexual perversion, but let's take something simple like the drugs, how it's supposed to be worse among black people. Now, I want to tell you the truth. I used to believe that largely because I myself, I'm black. I lived in black neighborhoods. So I assumed that, wow, this is bad. It can't be this bad among white folks. But guess what? There's a book called The Pipe Dream Blues, where they actually had some useful information. And they reported something that was out of an FBI report, that 85%, they had a profile of who is the crack, you know, who uses cocaine and crack. They said that it was a white man with a job over 40 is the average crack cocaine user. Or freebase user. Now, I thought, oh, it was a black thing. But that's because I lived in areas where they were predominantly blacks. But once you start to know the facts and look around, you see that even that's not true. And the FBI came up with the figure of 85% of the people that use crack in America are white. That's the FBI. Another racist myth is going to die here at Slave Revolt. And violent behavior? Well, of course, everybody's supposed to believe blacks, all the blacks, just, you know, look how they do each other and all that old foolishness. Unfortunately, that's mostly what we do, is each other. But in fact, when you want to see crazed, violent behavior, go and look at Abu Ghraib. Go and look at what's going on in this war. Is that not irrational, violent behavior? The way that the Iraqi population, unarmed, is treated by the American army, most of which is white? Think about it.
What also is going on is a situation where you have so many deeply rooted stereotypes that unless you take the time to break these guys off, then it fits right in nicely to the soundbite prepackaged concept that many people have. So, as Gerald was referring to, someone says, oh, black people are homophobic. And it's like end of discussion. Yet, if you look at many of the cases that are have been going on, where the violence has been committed, you see that it hasn't been happening and generally does not happen in the hood, as Gerald was referring to. But that type of just analysis and logic seems to go out of the window. Now, something else has also been spun out of control. And that is the way that the whole concept of where JL was saying that the CDC says, you know, talking about the HIV and we're losing so many of our people through the HIV. Because the numbers are so large, so frightening, so scary. And we're losing, not all, but some of our, many of our women, black women, because you're having unprotected sex with your boyfriends who they think are straight, but they've contacted HIV through their down-low boyfriend. Now, first, let me say this. Y'all know where my position is on this whole HIV type of stuff. The whole HIV hypothesis, which is really they test for the antibodies. They're not testing for an active retrovirus. Then they're saying that this antibody is supposed to cause one of 30 diseases. They started off not with one of 29 to 30 diseases. They didn't start off with that many. But now, as time has gone on, they've boosted it up to those numbers. Now, what's fascinating about this is many of those diseases, at least 24%, are not immune depressant diseases. Remember AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Leukemia, Kaposi sarcoma, dementia, those aren't immune deficient diseases. So if they're saying that HIV, the retrovirus, is what causes AIDS, your immune system breakdown, then why are 24% of those diseases that have existed before this whole AIDS thing, you know, Kaposi sarcoma, leukemia, all those diseases existed before there was this AIDS scare. Now they're saying that HIV causes those already previously established diseases. Well, how are they causing a number of diseases that have nothing to do with your immune system breakdown? It's never been really dealt with. They just ignore it. What they also ignore is that, you know, I looked, I said, well, how many people are they saying actually have AIDS in America, or HIV as they define it, in America since this whole pandemic? And come to find out that they vary. I've checked different types of logs, like AIDS in America, AVERT.org, AVERT.org, and their statistics. And they estimate that it varies, that the number of HIV positive people living in America varies between 900,000 and 1 million. Well, they're talking about since 1981. Where 400,000 people a year die just from smoking alone. A year. Now, they're saying that up to maybe 1 million people have HIV since 1981. We're not talking per year. They're saying the totals is up to a million. That's not no epidemic. That is not no epidemic. And it sure don't sound like no infectious disease either. Because if you then also break it down, I saw other statistics. And one was saying it was like 930,000. And the particular statistics, or there's so many, they throw a lot of jargon around. But one says that 930,000 people have are HIV positive. And that doesn't mean you're dead, you know. Now, if you use some of these DNA terminating drugs, you will most likely end up like Arthur Ashe dead, because it will terminate your DNA replication, you know, like it did to Ashe. But take on average, okay, since 1981 is 2005. So we're talking about 24 years. That means on average 38,750 people, if it's 930,000, who, you know, have been HIV positive since it bursted into the scene in 1981, 38,750 people have become HIV positive since 1981 per year in America. That's not an epidemic. Sorry. And if 40% of them are black, like they claim, or some say 50%, some say 40, this, you know, it's all over the place, then that's only 15,500. Now, black people are dying from a whole lot of stuff. And once again, this is not saying they're dying. This is saying that they, quote unquote, show positive. Now, you can show positive because the proteins for the, it's not a gold standard testing that they do. In other words, they're not testing exactly for HIV antibodies. They're testing for certain proteins. And some of those proteins that this retrovirus, antibody retrovirus has, turned out to be the same type of protein that people have for an assortment of things. Particular drugs they may take, pregnant women often, you know. So let's keep in mind that a lot of these are just false positives on a harmless retrovirus in the first place. So, to put it into perspective, if you break it down, you know, a million or 930,000, and then I saw that even when they say, they often use estimates. They say, well, it's estimated that another 100 to 180,000 don't know they're HIV positive. So they're just projecting out there. But see, often what they do is they don't give you the hard numbers like this. What they'll do is sly things like say that the black population has increased 15 times more than the white population, and the Hispanic population has increased X amount of time, you know. So it looks like things are just inflating out. But if you break it down to where they say up to a million people since 1981 have become HIV positive since the epidemic, then that breaks down to something that, you know, especially when you compare it to other diseases, and one out of every two persons in America gets some form of cancer, and that one out of every two males in America gets cancer, one out of every three females in this country gets cancer. And a lot of that's tied to the chemical, you know, plutonium-based society that we're injected in, et cetera. This puts other things into perspective. But, you know, when you talk about black people, you're not supposed to worry about breaking down the nuances like this. It's just them. Just blow it out like that. And then that way it creates this hysteria and like you're all being irresponsible. And it fits into the image that is already established.
Now, you see, what Tracy's talking about here is the politics of AIDS. And it's a real tragedy that indeed this disease has become so politicized. The origins are with the Food and Drug Administration. And what occurred was when the thing broke out and people started passing away, they admitted at first they didn't have no idea what was causing it. And then they started going on the search for, you know, a cure and all of this stuff. But in America, because capitalism is dying, this is not a period of enlightened capitalism. You know, when capitalism was first starting out, look at it like a virile young man who was really trying to conquer the world and learn new things and acquire new skills and theories and knowledge. There's an optimism there, you see? But as capitalism has proceeded, capitalism has now become an old, senile, bald-headed, wrinkled-up creature that is stumbling from crisis to crisis. So now, a simple thing like finding a cure for a serious illness immediately becomes politicized. Why? Because the drug companies get involved right away. They got their interests. They want to come up with the so-called accepted cure so that they can make what? Guess what? Money. That's what they care about. Then the victims, the people who they say were getting all of the AIDS stuff, they want a solution right now. They're dying. The same thing happened with cancer years ago. People were coming up with counter solutions. And today, right now, there are people that come up with counter solutions for cancer. And to be honest with you, I have no idea if there's any truth to what they're coming up with. But I'd like to know. I really wish I could know. But with the AIDS thing, it accelerated. The gays were demanding that the Food and Drug Administration release some of the solutions that people were coming up with and saying, well, look, let us just try it. And then, of course, there was some experimentation, this and that. And it got to the point where the capitalists, if you remember, we talked about the situation in Atlanta where all of these black children were showing up dead. The black families started to arm themselves and form defense guards with baseball bats patrolling their neighborhoods to make sure that no more of their children were snatched. The government felt compelled to come up with an answer. So they arrested this dude,
Wayne Williams.
Right, and even now they're considering letting him go because they know it was a frame-up. But look at the same dynamic. Here, this strange disease appears to be taking the lives of its citizens. The government has no answer. And people want to know, how could you have no answer? You can go to the moon. You got all kind of weapons that can go around the block and come up in through a keyhole and kill some. How the hell can't you solve this problem? They were desperate to come up with an answer.
But they weren't all that desperate on a certain level, because like when you had Robert Gallo come out in a press conference and say that HIV is what causes AIDS. And from there, it just kind of snowballed. So we had a quote-unquote confirmation that HIV causes AIDS through press conference.
That's right.
Not through imperial evidence.
Right. But Tracy, you know what I'm saying?
Not through debate.
Right.
Not through
scientific research.
Not having HIV and go through Koch postulates or anything like that.
Right.
So then you had, like you were saying, the other interests seize the time. You know, GlaxoSmithKline and all of that. So here they are the ones. Jerome Horowitz invented what in 1960 a cancer treatment drug called AZT.
Yeah.
It was so toxic that they never put it on the market. Actually, it was called Compound S at the time. When Gallo and them came forward with this quote-unquote HIV-AIDS hypothesis, they took it off the shelf, changed the name, let it slide through the FDA, and kaboom. Now you have a fake AIDS drug that's basically a DNA terminating drug that will have
you
die of AIDS-like diseases, many AIDS-like diseases, because it will destroy your T-cell and immune system and stop it from replicating, and then you will be susceptible to a number of diseases that are immune-deficient related.
But the point I was trying to get at, Trace, is that, yeah, maybe the government wasn't really all that desperate on one level, but for sure the victims were. And what they try to do to appease that situation is just as you described. Now, what does all this have to do with us? Well, I tell you the truth. I don't know if a large number of black women are showing up with AIDS. I really don't know what the facts are.
Well, first of all, like I just read, they said, and this is their own wording, that between 900 and 1 million people.
Yeah. No, I got that part. I got that.
And that's from 1981.
Yeah.
Okay, well...
no, I got that.
So yeah. Now, if you look at the same type of breakdown of people dying from smoking per year...
Yeah, it's nothing. It's nothing. But here's the point I'm trying to make, is that the government and its various charlatans and sophists and people that try to justify it, and it's hangers-on, and it's scientists, and all, they're very discredited people. Nobody with any damn sense really has a lot of confidence in them. So when somebody perceived this problem or thought they had this problem, what they do is they try to use the politics of panic to push people in various directions, you see. So instead of just telling people, look, you know, you check out a condom, that wouldn't hurt. No, there's got to be this panic. It's the down low going to get you. The candy man going to get
that's
you.
That's one aspect. They also, the politics of propaganda, they keep hyping up this stuff in the corporate media system.
Because they can't convince anybody.
Bombarding people with it. But not giving this solid evidence, like I said. You won't hear them talk about, you know, how many people in this country have quote-unquote contracted, according to them, HIV since the quote-unquote pandemic started. Instead, what they'll do is just flip it and tell you one group has increased by X amount of times and another group by X amount of times and men X amount versus women X amount, et cetera, and then do an estimated projection of how many people overall in this country. Then they throw in Africa and overhype that whole thing up, which goes by a whole nother parameter, the Banqui definition, and it just all becomes a mixture of propaganda and misdirection. But now let's move on as Davey asked King how black people are the most homophobic. So let's check out what King has to say.
What DL stands for. And I left you with the provocative question. Oftentimes, and again, in the context of how we as black men are viewed, we're oversexed, we're accused of being the most sexist, and now we're also accused of being the most homophobic. And before we went to the break, you said, yeah, we are, at least at the homophobic part. So I want you to elaborate on that, unless I misheard you.
Homosexuality is the greatest taboo in our community. There was a book that was released a couple of years ago called Homosexuality, the Greatest Taboo in the Black Community. We, in our community, are having a hard time accepting the fact that we do have homosexuality in our community. We didn't deal with it in the right way for years. Because if we had, we would not be at the place we are right now where HIV has taken its toll on our community.
Well, how does it manifest itself when we say homo, you know?
It goes back to the church, really. It goes way back further than that. But let's just talk about the church. There are a lot, you know, in our community, the church is the foundation of a lot of our neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of gay friends who go to church every Sunday and sit there and listen to their pastor talking about homosexuality is an abomination, you're going straight to hell, it's a learned behavior, you can stop that behavior, come to us, we can clear you of that demon.
Right.
Men who who and women.
Now, these are Christian men a lot of times.
Christian men who are saved, sanctified, filled with the Holy Ghost.
How's that different than what Jerry Falwell preaches on Sunday?
It's probably no different.
So why do we get the stigma in the white community where, you know, the Christian right, which is very much homophobic, mm-hmm. to the point that they want to pass constitutional amendments, mm-hmm. every senator and congressperson down the row, you know, they're all like, yes, we got to do that. 80% of the state of California, this liberal state of California, voted against gay marriage. So why does the black community get the burden of being this,
because hyper... Because it's true. I mean, let's keep it to a simpler start. It's true.
But how does that manifest? Itself.
I think it goes back, historically it goes way back. Again, my friends who are gay,
mm-hmm.
who can't be who they are in their community or in their fraternity or in their Masonic lodges or in their church, because the first thing that they're called are queers. The first thing people think about gay men in our community, that they're pedophiles. They want to have sex with every man who's walked. We have not gotten to a point where we have accepted homosexuality as part of our communities, man.
So have other communities accepted?
Yes. Look at TV. Look at Will and Grace. Look at Queer Guy for the Straight Guy. Look at 6 Feet Under. Look at characters that are on TV that show gay men being part of their community, not being
ostracized. But they're shown on TV, right? But does that mean they're accepted?
Yes,
when you have, then how do we have? Then how do we have a president that felt comfortable enough to float out passing a constitutional amendment?
I don't know.
How do we have the reaction to the gay marriage situation?
Of course,
which we saw.
Right.
Mostly white folks.
Yeah, you're
going to have doing that. And I don't think it was black folks leading the charge going...
black gay men are not at the forefront. There's a division in the gay community between black gays and white gays. You got white gay men saying, we're out here getting our butt kicks for equal rights and civil rights for the gay community at large. And gay black men are hiding because they're afraid to step up and join arms with us for equal rights. Because white gay men don't understand it. In the black community... that gay black man who still lives in the hood cannot go home and go to his church and stand up and say, I'm gay and proud, accept me. But look, one thing that we're not doing, we're not focusing on my new book. and that's why I'm here.
Right, right.
And we'll spend all our time talking about everything but my new book.
Right.
And so that's why I'm on this tour.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So my new book is about relationships and getting past this download issue.
Now you can see how sorry J.L. King is. All Davey was trying to do was ask him, you know, how does it manifest? You know, give us some evidence that black people's homophobia manifests in what type of way, what type of action. And then when he gives out a couple of examples of the larger society, the Jerry Falwells, the 80% of the California population voting down, you know, gay marriage, Boy George coming out against gay marriage and his little amendment or whatever the hell he was doing and stuff. JL had no response for that. He's like, oh, I don't know. And then tried to say that the proof that gay males are accepted in a society is because of TV shows like Queer Guy for the Straight Guy or what, Queer Eye for the whatever the hell it is. And so. What's taking place in commercialized land is proof? That's the silliest thing I've ever heard. But he wouldn't answer Davey directly about showing how it manifests, and just got flustered and stuff, and then tried to say that it was black males hiding and not coming out. In other words, it's the scared down low black males who are too scared to even come out and fight the good fight with their gay partners. Now, just today, I heard a thing where on the radio where blacks, gays, Latins, all of them have joined forces in San Francisco to combat all of the racism that's taking place in the Castro district in San Francisco, where black people aren't allowed into the little gay bars, the little, you know, they're gay white brothers. Latins aren't. Asians. The Asians had to do some little picketing. I heard one Asian dude say over the radio because they were being excluded. So they all had to, now they're all joining forces. It's a united front because... and they had gay women on talking about how they were being called niggas and this and that. Everything under the sun. And it basically just sounded like a bunch of redneck gays. And what they were describing was the only thing many of these white gay guys that they've been combating in the Castro over, the only thing they're progressive about is the issue of white gay male rights. But everything else, they can and often are just as backwards as you would expect Trent Lott to be. So, but JL doesn't bring any of this aspect in, of course, because it's the pathology of the Negro game. Blame the Negro. It's the Negro's fault. The Negro's fault that there's not more movement on the quote-unquote gay struggle. It's the Negro's overall fault and their homophobia against gays and black gays in general, etc. It's the Negro's fault for the way black women are quote-unquote down-low Negro's fault for, in part, how they're getting infected, black women, etc. The pathology game, the pathology card, the black pathology card game is being played itself in the light right here.
Now, let's try to play another card, the card of reason and facts. And just think, are black men more sexist in this society than white men? Well, no doubt there's a certain bombastic thing going on, you know, the bombastic. That's one thing. But are black men really more sexist than white men? I don't know if there's any truth there. Because, in fact, if you look at the problems emanating from our community, largely what you find is that it's one, economics, and then two, the other problem that you have a lot of, well, you know, one, the economics is a main kind of deal. But I think that you got a thing where this society, the capitalist, intentionally pits black men and black women against each other. And it's becoming common. So that you hear brothers say things like today, or the women's is getting all the jobs. Foolishness like that. Well, it is certainly true that in a service-oriented economy where the industry, the industrial side is shrinking, it is easier for women to get jobs as basically secretaries. They like to call them administrative assistants, but, you know, clerical type jobs.
And also that has a class bias to it, because how the hierarchical structure works in a patriarchal, male-dominated, class-based capitalist society is that white women, white men are on top of the economic ladder, then white women, then black males, then black women. I mean, as far as pay is concerned. So what often happens is that if they are looking at a black male and a black female who they have lower on the economic total pole, even though their position for the job may be the same and their qualifications is the same, they're going to look for the lowest common denominator, you know, who are they going to pay the cheapest.
Right.
It's just like a report that came out on another aspect of how the race card is played in this society. And that is, it turns out that white males who have a criminal background, a felonious background, are called back more than a black male who doesn't, applying for the same job and who has, other than the criminal background, the same type of qualification. So you have these types of dynamics interplaying in.
That's right.
Within this society.
That's a fact. Now, here's the other thing. All right, we spoke to the our skepticism to the point of our black folks more homophobic. But now that he mentioned the church as the source of the homophobia in the black community, I'm going to challenge that in a very clear way. I do not believe that it is true that black people are getting all this influence by the church. And in fact, that the black church influences the behavior of black citizens. I don't think that much, to be honest with you. And I'll tell you why. It is because the black churches in our communities and the origins of them, and you can trace this yourself, are primarily social organizations that provide entertainment versus an orthodox religious ideological outfit. You hear, now get me now. You see that? The black church was the only organization that black people were allowed to have. So the black churches became the spot where you got social welfare, you help the poor, you bury somebody that don't have a funeral, you do this, you do that. And you go to these black churches today and look, man, you can't get into a big black church where everybody wearing them fine clothes and mink coats in the middle of August. And then they got these choirs. And they break out with a band. I mean, a serious band. They be having some rhythm. Them bands be kicking. And they go on and do their little, you know, got their little a whole choir. And they be, and they get to doing their thing. And, you know, music is healing. You do. I like music. You know, I like some gospel music, tell you the truth. But it's the music I like. It ain't got nothing to do with the lyrics. Them folks be singing and dancing and hopping around and carrying on. Hell, you, at least you get some exercise before you leave. That is not a that's not the same politicization that they be putting on them in Farwell's church or Graham's church or none of them other institutions that are primarily transmitting ideology to the white population. Finish.
It's basically a form of relief and release.
Right.
They know
yeah,
this.
That's a fact.
But they want to mythologize it into something else. Hold on a sec. All right, as we're about to wrap this up, we're going to go into another aspect of the black pathology card that's often played out. Recently in the current edition of Middle East Report, there's an article by Hisham D. Adi. That's H-I-S-H-A-A-M-D Adi, A-I-D-I. He's a researcher at the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. He wrote an article called Slavery, Genocide, and the Politics of Outrage, Understanding the New, quote-unquote, Racial Olympics. Let's examine some of the things he has to say and how he breaks it down. He goes, Adi says, quote, in October of 1999, PBS aired The Wonders of the African World, a six-part documentary produced by the renowned African-American intellectual Henry Louis Gates, wherein the Harvard educator traveled from Egypt to Sudan and down the Swahili coast of East Africa and up through parts of West Africa, examining encounters between Arab, African, and Arab civilizations and the role Africans and Arabs in the enslavement of Africans. In Egypt, Gates reflects on the facial features, quote-unquote, of monuments in Aswan, noting the blackness, quote-unquote, of the pharaohs and pondering whether construction of the Aswan Dam that inundated ancient Nubia was an act of Arab racism. In the coastal Kenyan cities of Lamu and Mombasa and on the island of Zanzibar, he talks to a number of natives who, to his dismay, define themselves as being Arab or Persian descent. To me, quote, people here look about as Persian as Mike Tyson, unquote. Gates remarks, quote, it's taken my people 50 years to move from Negro to Black to African American. I wonder how long it would take the Swahili to call themselves African, unquote. The Wonders of the African World was guided by particularly American conceptions of race and blackness, the most obvious being the one-drop rule, quote-unquote, by which anyone deemed possessing so much as one drop of black blood was to be considered fully black and subjected to the legal system of racial domination known as Jim Crow. Asked by one critic why he considered ancient Egyptians more authentically African than modern Egyptians, Gates responds, quote, I suspect that if the average ancient Egyptian had shown up in Mississippi in 1950, they would have been flung into the back of the bus, and that's black enough for me, quote unquote. By emphasizing the role of Arabs and Africans in the slave trade, Gates was engaging in the common American practicing of allocating racial guilt, quote unquote. In this case, underlying Arab and African blame, quote unquote, for slavery. As one African reviewer wrote, quote, some of us fear that in his efforts to repair relations between white America and black America, Gates may be sowing the seeds of discord between African Americans and the peoples of the African continent, unquote. Okay, let me stop right there and start dealing with some of this. What's kind of interesting is, oh no, wait, let me just say this part too, because this last little. Black nationalists are not the only group in the United States that claim certain cultures, spaces, and eras of Arab world as theirs for their own purposes. Christians and Jewish nationalists have long been imbued by Orient with redemptive significance. But while Christian and Jewish cultures' affiliations with Middle East have historically been staunchly Zionist and pro-Israel, African-American constructions of North Africa and the Middle East have been ambivalent about Zionism and more willing to engage with other nationalist movements. All right, so basically, he's trying to connect Gates as some kind of nationalist by saying that, which clearly Gates is not some little nationalist. But on top of that, what he's also trying to do is when he says, by emphasizing the role of Arabs and Africans in the slave trade, Gates was engaging in the common American practice of allocating racial guilt, quote unquote. Now, there's obviously some game going on here. Because, I mean, anyone has to do is look at the shows we did on Gates and know that we're not sided with Gates' overall political views and so on and so forth. And that's on the Slave blog for anyone to check out at their own discretion. But at the same time, anyone who tries to deny of some of the role of some of these kingdoms, African-based kingdoms, many of whom were Muslim, that engaged in parts of the slave trade, or the Arab and Persian, or what I just generally call the Islamic-based slave trade, is out of their mind. Now, I've mentioned Zanj before. There were many others I've also mentioned, which took the Zanj were black people in the eastern part of Africa that were enslaved, held the mighty slave revolt that lasted for 15 years in what is now called Baghdad. All anyone has to do is go to your Google web and put in Zanj Revolt, Z-A-N-J Revolt. And you'll see books like Revolt of the Blacks. They're very well documented and stuff that were written about the Zanj Revolt against their Arab slavers. There's books out now talking about the Islamic slave trade that took place and chattled numbers of whites to parts of the quote-unquote Arab or Islamic world, you know, in the Middle East region and stuff like that. To try to pretend that this type of stuff did not happen,
right,
is just junk. Now, Gates also has been involved with another African writer where they talk specifically about the African the role that certain African regions played in the slave trade. There's I've mentioned the role of kingships, which is one of the reasons why I'm against kingships, the hierarchical structure and their affiliation with trading. So, we constantly hear these people trying to play this kind of denial game that the catastrophe that took place against black people is like some kind of figment of someone's imagination, or trying to play some kind of racial guilt game. Now, next, the guy goes on. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I just a point about race and identity and this whole historical problem. You know, for years, the Palestinian leadership that has been predominantly nationalist itself has tried to play the card of mutual third world nationalism here in the United States, looking for common ground with black nationalists. But there's only, I got one word that kind of exploded and undermined all of that. That word? Sudan. When they were talking about slavery still existing in the world, one of the places where that was actually going on was in Sudan. And I remember, you see, the opportunistic sect, the Nation of Islam, was trying to snuggle up to them Arabs, thinking they're going to get some of that oil money, right? And somebody jammed old Farrakhan up and said, yo, man, what you got to say about this slavery thing? He said, well, we're going to look into that. And, And you know what? They ain't said a damn word about that. They done kept it on the QT. They on the down low. Because they can't get that oil money and tell the truth at the same time. So what you get is a situation. Now, this is where the race and identity thing comes in. If you're in Africa for decades upon decades upon decades, everybody started getting kind of dark. So if you look at an African from Sudan, historically from Sudan, and you look at an Arab that is living in Sudan and has lived there for generations, you don't immediately see the difference because they're both rather dark, to be honest with you. Or at least they have some color to them. They're not, you know. But in fact, there are differences. One, religion thing. A lot of the Africans considered themselves Christians. This fueled into the so-called religious controversy.
We're in the north-south region, you know, that is Christian and animist. And a lot of the black people who became Christians, they became Christians in the same way that many black people in America become Muslims. They see Islam as
oppressive.
The imperial force. Right. And so in just the same way you see blacks, the ones that do turn to Islam, say, well, you know, look, man, I ain't going with the white man's religion.
Right.
I'm you know, that type
right.
of thing.
Right. But this does understand something. When you start to raise with Palestinian nationalists the question of the mistreatment of Africans in Sudan by Islamically spirited Arabs, you either get extreme hostility or denial.
What's also interesting is he was trying to say the issue of black nationalists are not the only type in the United States to try to claim area, culture, spaces in the Arab world. Well, first of all, when you're talking about a place like Egypt, Egypt was, Arabs were the last people to conquer Egypt. Egypt had been conquered by Alexander 333 BC. It was conquered by the Romans, the Turks. So in other words, The ancient Egyptians lost their sovereignty centuries ago. And you had all kinds of population movements, upheavals, etc., etc. The Arabs were the last to conquer it with General Amir. It was like in 670 AC. And that's when you saw the Arabicization. The Arabs didn't see that at the time as part of their lineage and stuff. The pyramids actually had a limestone base on it. The Arabs took it off to build mosques and stuff. They were selling the mummies and stuff like that to anyone. I mean, because they didn't have any kind of historical
connection to it. Right?
The Sphinx, they named it the Father of Terror. Now, anyone who knows about Egyptology and stuff knows that the Sphinx is not looked on as, you know, the Father of Terror. But if you're coming from an alien perspective and an alien culture, then it's not surprising that you would look at it in that particular way. So there's a game going on when you hear this guy, you know, Babylon and on like this. But next he goes into Malcolm and he says, Malcolm X was one of the first to try to reconcile Arab and black nationalism. Tells of the transforming encounter he had with an Algerian diplomat in Ghana. I was speaking with an Algerian, Malcolm says, ambassador, who is extremely militant and is a revolutionary in the true sense of the word. When I told him that my political, social, and economic philosophy was black nationalism, He asked me very frankly, well, where did that leave him? Because he was white. He was an Algerian. And to all appearances, he was a white man. And he said, if I define my objective as the victory of black nationalism, where does that leave him? Unquote. Now, basically what happened is Malcolm was taking a particular program out into another sector of the world where basically he was, you know, coming into different types of dynamics and stuff. But what this guy is trying to use is, like, say, try to discredit Malcolm. Now, I'm not a black nationalist or anything, but he's trying to discredit that type of thinking based off of this type of analysis and stuff, but not bring in, in other words, say, look, the Negroes are silly with this type of analysis, but not bring in the fact of the dynamics that have played out in that particular region. Now, the reason why I mention this is that there's a couple of people I'm going to mention, and one throughout this, and one is a woman named Kola Ball. She's a black woman that I'm sure most of our listeners have never heard of. Kola, K-O-L-A, Ball, or Booth, B-O-O-F. And she's an interesting woman by the fact that she was actually born in the Sudan. Her father was Arab, Egyptian. Her mother was a Sudanese woman, a black Sudanese woman. She saw her parents get killed when she was a little girl by basically some government-sponsored assassins because both her parents were protesting against slavery. Then what happened was she was shipped over to her Arab grandmother and family side in Egypt. The grandmother said, you're too dark, and didn't accept her. So she ended up in America because a black family ended up adopting her from America, and she grew up in Washington, D.C. from then on. She's a writer. She's written many books, so on and so forth. And she is extremely hard on some of these issues. I don't agree with all her positions and stuff, but here's some of the stuff she had to say and her effort to deal with the Sudan issue. This is Kola. Quote, slavery is just a terrible symptom of a horrible disease that has been in Sudan for centuries now. You know, you have ethnic cleansing in Sudan. The light-skinned Arabs are the elite, the ruling class. Everyone wants to look to be them, look like them, and be accepted by them. But what everyone doesn't want is to be Muslim. This is what causes the civil war. My country is divided into the Arab Muslim North, which is where I'm from, because my father was an Egyptian Arab Muslim, and then the South, which is very African and populated by charcoal black people, the original Kushites, as a matter of fact, the Dinka, Nuer, Sukos, Seleuks, and others. In the middle, we have people who are my color, dark brown, but most of them are mixed, and they do not consider themselves African. Even as dark as me, they will slap you if you call them black or African. They want to be considered Arab. Many of them are Nubians who mix with light Arabs. These Nubians straighten their hair, and they go to Turkey and marry white street prostitutes and bring them back to Sudan and try to pass them as respectable women, all because they do not want to breed, because they want to breed lighter children who can pass for Arab. That is the goal. Many Nubians who can become my color will turn on their own families and run away and embrace Islam. So the root of colorism is what causes the ethnic cleansing in the Sudan. Now she goes on and says, I believe that religions are man-made. They are not God. God is God. Religions are just institutions that men come up to have power and control. I would like to see us women start our own religion. But anyway, I have scorned Islam, which is punishable by death. That's the nature of the religion, you see. And I revealed that all over the Arab world, black African people are enslaved and treated like cattle, mainly and foremost because they are black. The Arabs have a word that's like nigger. It's abid, which means slave race. This is what they reserve for blacks. Even the Arab blacks that with so-called good hair and brown skin are called abid. Have you ever seen dogs chained up to the back doors of houses, dogs who live outside and eat outside? Well, in Arab countries, there are black men's children chained to the back of houses this way. There are black women who work in Arab kitchens. She goes on to say, why don't you just ask Mr. Louis Farrakhan? He's good friends with Sudan's Arab Islamic president, al-Bashir. Farrakhan loves the Arab Muslim government of North Africa. They're his biggest supporters. He goes, the black Africans have a name for Minister Farrakhan. I use it too. We call him the white bastard. They go on and say,
oh, Lord, have mercy, Jesus.
She then mentions that, you know, I know he might have us killed, huh? Murdered in the name of Allah, you know. It's a shame Malcolm X had to die in Africa. In Africa, we really love Malcolm X. We call him Red Rooster. He was an authentic black man, a king among men. Him, I would like to give birth to again. He was every black child's dream. It's a shame that the Arabs only showed Malcolm their living rooms when he visited their world, their mosque. If he had seen what they had tied up in their bedroom or pacing the kitchen or tied to the back door, he would not have been fooled. So here you have a situation where here's a person who grew up in the culture. Now there's a book by this girl called Mindy. It's called Slave. She gives her experience as a Nuba being enslaved. She escaped. There's many aspects that black people have been finding out through the years that has gotten the attention about this issue. Cola also goes on and says this. Yes, let's talk about something else. Cowardly hypocrites like Jesse Jackson and Minister Farrakhan make me sick to my stomach. This is why we black women must give birth to some real men, men of honor. So, so this
don't
is
say no more, bro. That's enough for one day. What you trying to do, man? Where's this sister at? She alive now?
Yeah, okay. Let me give a little background about recently, or now a few years back, the Sudan government put a death sentence on her, a fatwa, and some Arab Muslims in L.A. tried to kill her. She had her gun and shot back at them. So she had to go through hiding and stuff like that, and some brothers through different regions, whenever she would do book signings and all that, would go and protect her and work with her and so on and so forth. She's not really hiding in the same way that she was just a couple of years ago. But I point this out is that I know most people don't even know that this whole thing has been done, and that this woman has existed, that you had an Arab, these little knuckleheads in the Sudan put a death threat out on her because of her positions, et cetera, et cetera, that some Arab Muslims actually tried to kill her in L.A., et cetera, et cetera. See, this is how these guys who write these...
Wait, did they catch these dudes?
Not that I know of.
Oh, they just shot and ran.
They shot... She started shooting. You know, when they tried to kill her. So, but let's go on with this slob's article in the Middle East report. He also goes, says that the anti-Arab black nationalism has found expression in a new initiative demanding reparations from the Arab League for Arab slavery and the campaign to penalize Sudan for the Darfur tragedy. Both efforts are inspired by the view that Arab-speaking North Africans of all hues are an alien race on African soil. Since 9/11, this view has gained popularity outside black nationalist circles, leading to a rapprochement between black nationalist groups and rival Zionist groups over Sudan, akin to the Jewish evangelical reconciliation over Israel. Such developments are best explained by an enduring feature of U.S. policy and politics. Racial scapegoating. Okay, let me stop right there right quick. What has inspired black people in general to be against the policies is what is going on, seeing this genocide take place. In the same way that you have seen black people being in an uproar and speak out what is going on, what has gone on in Haiti and stuff. It has nothing to do with the fact that one group is Arab or not. It has to do with the policies that black people keep seeing take place. Now, people need to go back and check out the two features I did on the Sudan to get more of a historical backing. Now, some of this Arab identity stuff, it was created by the Arabs who saw themselves as conquerors as they came into the Kush region of Nubia, so on and so forth, as conquerors, as exploiters. You had people since that time, like Gaddafi, decide he wants to make an Arab belt, which went right through the Darfur region. He didn't see the original inhabitants as Arab. So he was arming many of the people who are called Janjaweed. This is Gaddafi from Libya, because he had these visions of an Arab belt. This was like in 1987. Many of those seeds still have presided since that time. So many of these things have been going on, and black people have been privy to them. There would be more explosion from black people in America if black people weren't so inundated with so many other issues. Black people have their hands full as it is. But the situation of contempt with what's happening with black people in Darfur and with the South has been a long-going process of intolerance, in the same way that black people have been intolerant towards the actions of the U.S. imperial machine, and it showed it by the numbers, overwhelming numbers that were against the invasion into Iraq right from the beginning. It had nothing to do with the fact that these people in Iraq were Arab, and it didn't stop black people from siding against the invasion because the people were Arab. Now, this writer, Adid, goes on. Historians have argued that racial scapegoating was crucial to the consolidation of the American nation state. Since intra-white conflict was often resolved by institutionalizing common prejudices against blacks, various reports assessing the impact of 9/11 attacks on American politics argue that the attacks reordered racial divisions. A survey gauging attitudes towards various ethnic groups, for instance, found respondents giving, quote, more favorable ratings to all groups except the Arab and Muslim Americans, who received less favorable ratings because they were associated with the attacks on the World Trade Center. These figures should come as no surprise. Nationalism, after all, has been defined as the, quote, wish to suppress the internal divisions within the nation and define people outside the group as untrustworthy as allies and implicitly evil as enemies, unquote. Let me stop right there. Now look, what's interesting about this is that to try to say that there's a major reordering of racial divisions, first of all, America's always been polarized on the racial issues. Arabs were often demonized through Hollywood, so on and so forth, before 9/11. Of course, yes, that this highlighted it, but there's not been any kind of reshuffling type of thing. Now, look, let's just take a look at some of the incidents that have happened towards black. Because what he says is, the September 11th attacks and the war on terror have thrown American racial politics into flux, Adiz says, producing a new enemy, new alliances, and sending different groups scrambling for a better spot in the ethnic pecking order. As the earlier years of the Cold War, the post-September 11th period constitutes a critical juncture where past political alignments are becoming undone as some ethnic and political groups mobilize to resist reigning policies and ideas, while others rally to reap political benefits by staunchly supporting efforts to contain the Islamic threat. The Save Darfur campaign is in many ways captures the new racial climate. So what he's trying to say is there's been a reshuffling. Blacks see some reprieve, so now they're trying to get on the bandwagon of attacking people like Arabs along with the larger society. Now let's look at this realistically. What are some of the things that have happened towards black people in the last few months? Okay, a black kid, 6 years old, was tasered. A black woman who was 8 months pregnant, tasered. A black male in Compton, unarmed, was shot at 120 plus times while he was in his car. You had a situation where it came out that black kids, some of them who had no disease whatsoever, were given non-FDA approved DNA terminating
drug,
HIV, quote unquote, drug,
as guinea pigs.
Tuskegee experiment part 2.
Oh yes.
So as black people know and have been experienced, ain't nothing changed for black folks. The game is still the same. So to try to play like all of a sudden black people feel some reprieve and now are trying to shuffle and play some other type of game is ridiculous.
Absolutely.
It's some of the sickest type of stuff that one can imagine. But also, you know, I'm going to mention something else that you guys should also check out. Now, here's another woman who's down for the cause, who I'm quite sure that most of our listeners have not heard of. Her name is Carol Shahadi. She's an Arab writer. Her father is Arab Egyptian, and her mother is Lebanese. Now, what's interesting about this is that she's written books like Big Little White Lies, Our Attempt to White Out America. And she writes about the racial politics that many immigrants, including specifically Arab immigrants, do to try to align themselves with quote-unquote whiteness at the estrangement and at the basically smashing of black people. She wrote this. This is a little thing, the racial lessons of 9-1-1. Profiled, feared, detained, assaulted, accused, interrogated, harassed, hated, and collectivized. Since 9/11, Arab Americans have been recipients of what it feels like to be temporarily black. Although it is wrong to treat Arab Americans like criminals, we shouldn't be surprised when we are treated in ways African Americans have been treated for centuries. Still, many in my Arab American community are surprised when we are treated unwhite. We figured that if we played by the racial rules of this country, we would be bypassed in receiving some of the bigotry that blacks routinely receive. Yet that old cliche of what goes around comes around finally showed itself to be more than another cliche. The backlash we're now receiving is from the same whip we've borrowed to lash out against African Americans. Currently, the Arab American community is having a hard time trying to figure out why we've been racially demoted from ethnic house slave to ethnic field slave. I am less disappointed in how my ethnic group has been signaled out and more disappointed in how we have been pathetically courting the very white privilege that has the power to decide which group will be signaled out. Therefore, with the anniversary of 9/11 upon us, we need to be completely honest as Arab Americans and ask ourselves whether or not we have been ethnic models of anti-racism. My heart tells me no. Although 9/11 represents many things to different people, one of its most interesting features is how the events after 9/11 can gauge how far we've come to understand the disease of racism. As I walked through the diverse neighborhoods in New York City shortly after the carnage of 9/11, I noticed many non-black people of color had aggressively decorated their homes and vehicles with American flags. The more immigrants in the area, or the more the residents resemble Arabs, the more flags I saw lightly fluttering in the air. I thought to myself that it is too bad black people cannot lightly wave their flags in the air whenever members from their own race experience problems. Unlike Arab Americans, the flag that African Americans know is too heavily drenched in blood and tears that it can never lightly flutter anywhere. Looking at how Arab Americans use flags reminds me of the biblical story when God of Moses instructed the Hebrews to mark their doors with blood so that the wrath of God bypasses their homes. Like countless immigrants communities before 9/11, many Arab Americans freely participated to covert and overt acts of racism against African Americans. This is no secret to most black people who already knew that Arab Americans have the same type of superior complex that European Americans do. This superiority complex is not only evident in the way we act towards them, but the way we choose to disassociate ourselves from their community. Our disassociation would not be so evident if it weren't ruthlessly trying to move up the racial hierarchy so that we can be closer to whiteness. Unfortunately, every non-black immigrant group has worked hard to secure a so-called respectable place above blacks on the racial hierarchy. When groups like Italians, Jews, Hispanics, Asians, and now Arabs have faced their turn to be questioned on their allegiance towards upholding the protocol of the caste structure, few fully challenge the legitimacy of this racist precondition to be accepted as Americans. In other words, none of these immigrant groups aggressively acted in a way where they stood by the lowest on the hierarchical racial order. As the Arab American community contends with the discrimination we're facing, we have been a little more sympathetic about some of the issues African Americans have always contended with, but which we did not believe until they started happening to us. Instead of seeing the bigger picture of racism by creating permanent and stronger ties with the black community, we often use them as temporary residents where we find people sensitive to our plight. I say temporary because we are not trying to stay black. In contrast, the only impermanent feeling we have towards whites is that our eviction from whiteness is nothing more than a temporary inconvenience. As long as we repay our dues by not challenging whiteness in any real way, then whites in exchange will trust us again and reinduct us back into the racial position we held prior to 9/11. History holds us that as long as we follow the formula of selling out our color to the highest bidder, then whiteness will accept us back quicker than they will blacks. Now it goes on from there. But my whole point is that here's another writer, an excellent writer who writes on many topics. One of the things you'll find out from Carol Shahidi is that you don't see her in many of the Arab discussion groups. It's people, black websites and stuff like that that you see her in. It's like she's been evicted from the discussion of overall people of color, at least the non-black people of color, as she describes it. Including her particular book. Now, this is a similar situation that Tim Wise has found himself in. Tim Wise is an anti-particular writer who anti-racist writer who speaks on many of these issues and you don't see him discussed that much within the white community on these particular issues because of historically where he stands as being an anti-racist. Now, let's go back to this Adid's article in the Mideast Report. The Save Darfur campaign in many ways captures the new racial climate. A different ethnic and political division has been set aside, and grievances are externalized on the Middle East. As in the Cold War, race has emerged as an ideological crutch in the war of words between the U.S. and the Arab world, as various actors use charges of racism to expose the other side's alleged double standards. Let me stop right there. Now, all one has to do is go back when I read that whole article one time out of the LA Times. It's on the blog. It's another thing where basically the U.S. has been cooperating with the Sudan, and the Sudan has been cooperating with the U.S. empire on the whole war on terrorism. These are two marketeers working together and have the same type of hierarchical order concept on their populations that the other one does. Both of them have disposable people. Both of them practice various forms of genocidal warfare, and both of them don't have problems. And the Sudan government has been cooperating with the U.S. empire in its war on quote unquote terror, which means war on humanity type of efforts. One just hides under the cloak of Christianity. One just hides under the cloak of Islam. But one is basically a Christopher Columbus with a turban on, and another is a Christopher Columbus with cowboy boots on. That's the real world. Now, another thing is that when he mentions this, if Farrakhan has sided with the with al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, and tries to pretend that the slave that these flesh traders aren't flesh traders, and it's just a game going on. But another thing is that many black people all throughout the world have been shocked to find out some of their experiences, like this one brother who was from Senegal, who was a Muslim. He was in Morocco. He wrote in a Sudanese paper how he was just crossing the street and the cop yelled at him, Abid, get, wait, you know, and all of that type of stuff, meaning black slave. So he's calling this cat from Senegal who was just visiting Morocco a black slave. So this is nothing all that shocking or anew. Now also, there's a in a Sudanese Sudan Tribune, there's an article written by Hannah Baba. This is a Sudanese sister. She grew up mainly in America, but you know, she's from Sudanese descent. She wrote an article in April 20th, 2005, where she talks about the other quote-unquote Darfur crisis. And this is what she has to say right quick. When people talk about the Darfur crisis, they're probably referring to the vicious conflict in Western Sudan where hundreds of thousands have died and more than a million displaced. But people from Darfur have another problem, a social one that's more widespread and found smack dab in the center of Sudan. My parents came to the U.S. from Sudan when I was a baby. Later on in life, we went to live there so that we Americanized, quote-unquote, kids could get in touch with our roots. I didn't expect what I found. Living in Khartoum was a fruitful experience. Being in the capital made it a magnet for a wide array of people from all parts of the country. I got to know my family, aunts, uncles, grandmothers, cousins. As I was feeling my way through mannerism tradition, what was rude to say, how to be generous to your guests, I came across something I heard of before in America but hadn't witnessed firsthand until then. One day I was sitting at a wedding among a group of middle-aged women. I was enjoying the singer as she banged on her daluka drum and sang up a storm when a word caught my ear, Abid. In my world, in my family, that was a very, very bad word, equivalent to the word, the American N-word, meaning nigger. Except here, they were referring to people from Western Sudan, the people of Darfur. My mind resisted eavesdropping, but my ears wouldn't hear heed the call. I attentively listened in curiosity and heard their conversation about a girl who was getting married. It went something like this. Maram, did you hear that Amira's daughter is marrying a Westerner? Oh, I did hear. How are they giving their daughter to that Abid? Are they insane? Are there no more free men around? I almost choked on my sponge cake. I never heard open racism like this. I had heard of it, but hadn't heard it, even in my days as a black child in Texas. It was flabbergasting to me that such ugly hate talk could be heard at such a happy occasion. After that day, I started to observe more closely and realized much of Khartoum astonishingly felt the same. It was so foreign to me. My parents always taught us that humans are equal and nobody is better than anybody because of their race or tribe. Obviously, many Sudanese didn't get the memo. And an intriguing point is that the racism always surfaced when marriage was involved. So here's this Sudanese sister talking once again about her. Now, you don't hear this guy. He doesn't really get into some of these real types of nuances because basically it's all about the black pathology game. This is how the game is played. Now, unfortunately, in classic slave revolt fashion, we've ran out of time. And he talks about Cornel West and W.E.B. Du Bois and so on and so forth. And it's important enough for me to deal more with this slob and how he tries to basically do an analysis that basically is just focusing primarily on black people's behavior, how black people are analyzing black people's action. Now, and then he calls it, you know, his article is called, as I said in the beginning, Slavery, Genocide, and the Politics of Outrage, Understanding the New Racial Olympics. Racial Olympics? We're talking about genocide in the Sudan, but they want to turn it in, or he wants to turn it in, to some kind of game. Like we're playing games here. In the same way that many fools like to say this race car game. Ain't no one playing games. This is about humanity. Slave Rope be back. More on this later. Hold on. That's just going to about wrap it up with Slave Revolt. Fortunately, we ran out of time. But through all the madness and savagery that we have to deal with, these hypocrites, these slobs who write this report, who try to play the black pathology game, we know that in the end, a change is going to come. Until the next time, Slave Revolt.